Hello, everybody, and welcome to our extended preview of our What a Cartoon Movie all about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, a real dear of a reindeer who is here with me today.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and why weren't you at elf practice?
And if you like that voice, you'll be hearing it a lot because we love doing the voice of the boss elf. But yes, welcome to an extended preview of our look at Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the 1964 Rankin-Bass special. Because you're listening to this on the free feed or the $5 Patreon feed, you're going to hear a bit of the history, probably like 45 or 50 minutes, of the fascinating history of Rankin-Bass and the Japanese stop-motion animators that put this special together back in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned a ton about it. This thing that's been around for over 50 years now, half a century of Rudolph in our lives, and I learned a ton from it. It was so fun talking about this special because it's like the Christmas special of all of them. We've covered so many, and we're going to cover a couple more, but this one is like the one, like the bedrock of Christmas specials.
Yes, we have a lot of fun talking about it. You know what? Christmas is the season of giving, and I say why not give yourself a gift by signing up for the $10 Patreon tier at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. If you do, you'll hear the rest of this podcast, the remaining like 3 hours of it, where we talk about this special in detail, play clips, go over trivia, and again, do the screaming elf voices that you love. And you'll also hear everything we've done so far, now 3 complete years of What a Cartoon Movie.
Yeah.
So I take that's like 35 other episodes we've done.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Which I would say is easily over 200 hours of bonus podcasts, in addition to the many, many, many bonus podcasts that you get as a patron at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
Yes. And if you enjoy stop motion animation, you might enjoy last year's look at Wallace and Gromit's Curse of the Were-Rabbits.
Mm-hmm. Or The Nightmare Before Christmas the year before that, which owes so much to this special. And there's dozens and dozens more that you could listen to that I think, as if you're enjoying our Batman one, our Batman miniseries right now, we've done 2 different Batman films as part of our What a Cartoon Movie.
Maybe next year we'll do Sub-Zero.
Yeah,
for the chilly months.
Yeah, that'd be good for the winter season next time too, yeah.
Yes, but that's it for our little preamble. Again, if you want to hear the entire thing and get access to the rest of our What a Cartoon Movie catalog, please go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. So without further ado, here is our history of the famous Christmas mascot re-engineered to sell General Electric products. So let's talk about the history of the character Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because I won't be talking about the history of Santa Claus. That is not my responsibility. Please look it up on your own. It's very interesting, but you know, he's made up, so he's a fake guy. I'm sorry for all of our children listeners out there who might still believe in him. If you're listening to this with your family, I'm sorry I ruined Christmas.
You should have put a spoiler warning up front with that. He was invented by the Coca-Cola Corporation, right?
They dressed him up in a certain way. They put him on some cans. The rest is history.
Right, yes. He went down in history first before old Rudolph did.
So Rudolph is a relatively recent invention and predates the special by just a handful of decades. So the idea of a Father Christmas-style character dates back to the 16th century, but Santa's reindeer entered the picture much, much later. So part of this was me thinking, okay, first come the reindeer. When did they enter the picture? Well, they came about in 1821 with the book, a very long titled book, A New Year's Present, to Little Ones from 5 to 12.
Wow.
So in this, a poem details Santa as being pulled by a reindeer sleigh, though the illustration in this book only shows one reindeer. And I don't think the poem lists the amount of reindeer.
Well, you know, it would be the curse of animators for years to come once they expanded the number of reindeer to 8. Oh. Like a lot of people, when they animate Santa Claus in their cartoons, we talked about it when we did the Pokemon one with Santa Claus. That's like, you know, they have one Rapidash that's pulled this sleigh. Like, no 8 of them, just one.
I think this really gets most of the reindeer on the screen at once.
It's a
big technical feat.
They have to. It is key to the song, like that. The song forces them to meet that level of technical expertise. Yeah.
So I want to read the excerpt from this poem that details the reindeer. So here it goes. It's from the book again. A New Year's Present to the Little Ones from 5 to 12. So the poem goes, old Santa Claus with much delight, his reindeer drives this frosty night, o'er chimney tops and tracks of snow, to bring his yearly gifts to you. whatever. Okay. Vowels shifted over the centuries, okay?
Sure, yes.
So that's what happened to Santa Claus.
Ah.
And so the next literary source really canonized the idea of Santa's reindeer by giving a definitive number and naming them. And of course, that is the much more famous poem, 1823's A Visit from St. Nicholas. So 1821, this poem is like, bam, they're reindeer. 1823 is like, let's name those fuckers.
Yeah, yeah. As I guess... like, everybody calls it Twas the Night Before Christmas, right?
Right, it's a better name.
Yeah, yeah, that's what Rankin Bass, years later, would be like, fuck this Visit from St. Nicholas.
Yeah.
It's Twas.
We tested it, and this tests better. Mm-hmm. So, those reindeer, of course, are Blitzen, Comet, Cupid, Dasher, Prancer, Vixen, Dancer, and Donner. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Donner and Blitzen, I believe, are German for thunder and lightning.
Ah, yes. Well, I guess Klaus is Santa Claus. It is a Germanic... well, I guess... a lot of what Americans do are taken from
the Germans.
Christmas time it's from the Germans.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there was a bunch of stuff in the 1900s that made us want to forget the German roots of things. But
and yeah. I also learned that because someone will put this in the comments that Blitzen and Donner were Blixem and Donder in the original Dutch, I think, which is thunder and lightning in Dutch.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow. That makes
the rest of those make sense. But in case you're wondering what Blitzen and Donner is, thunder and lightning.
Okay.
Basically.
Yeah. Just in general, I guess fast. Like these are all fast reindeer. Which, yeah, I get. As a kid, I was probably extra attracted to Rudolph because I love a growing history and mythology to mm-hmm. these things that, like, well, there's Santa Claus, and then he gets one reindeer, and then he has eight of them, and they're named, and like, okay, well, we know all these names. Where does it go from there?
Really, Rudolph is the Poochie of these reindeer.
He really, yes, yeah.
He's got an attitude. He's got a red nose.
Everybody's asking where he is. Yeah, and he's a little kid, so every kid can be super invested in him more mm-hmm. than all the dad guys on the rest of the reindeer.
So the funny thing about both of these poems is that they're both published anonymously with no accreditation. But then there was a big controversy over the person who eventually took the credit for A Visit from St. Nicholas and whether or not he actually wrote the poem. But it's very complicated. So technically, these are both anonymous poems that canonized the idea of reindeer with Santa Claus.
I guess, you know, as early days of publishing in America, I suppose, that's so funny. Somebody can just say, like, I did it. Me.
And that guy, he's got a name, but he took a lot of credit for it. But maybe he wrote it. Maybe another guy wrote it. Who knows? So let's cut to 100 years in the future to 1939, a year where nothing could possibly go wrong except the beginning of World War II, mm-hmm. which is when it happened. Mm-hmm. But back in America, things are nice and quiet, and the department store chain Montgomery Ward had a tradition of buying and giving away coloring books to kids every Christmas. But this was the year they were like, we can save money if we make our own. So if we publish our own coloring book instead of buying existing ones, we can save a ton of money on this promotional giveaway.
Wow.
So they tapped one of their ad men, Robert May, to come up with an idea. May was a big hit at company parties with funny limericks and funny song parodies, and I assume they were all filthy and racist, but who knows? So the top brass were like, May, you're the man for the job. You are our new coloring book poem writer, or whatever his title was.
So this is all born out of advertising a department store.
It was born in the ad department of Montgomery Ward,
and
Rudolph.
All the guys who were like the old men on Mad Men, they helped make this.
Yes. Like, it's funny, Montgomery Ward is just like dead now. Now, but yeah. Rudolph persists.
Montgomery Ward was barely alive when we were children.
Yeah.
And we got to watch it die. I remember there was a Montgomery Ward next to a Target, and I got to see it shut down.
When I lived in Kent, Ohio for grad school, I would drive by just this massive, cavernous, abandoned Montgomery Ward every day.
Man. And now that's most things in Kent, I would say.
Everything fell. I mean, every big box store, like the Circuit Cities of the world, they're just cavernous, empty warehouses now.
Yeah. I would bet nothing's still in that Circuit City in my old hometown as well. Just an aging red plug in the ground.
Maybe Halloween Spirit Superstore.
Yeah.
So May had a pitch for this Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer guy, but his pitch was turned down because at the time, a bright red nose was a symbol of being an alcoholic.
Oh.
So they were like, what are you trying to pawn off some drunk reindeer on these kids, you sicko? But he eventually accepted it because May got a friend from the art department at Macy's Ads to come up with sketches. But tragedy struck during the development of this book because May's wife passed away from cancer.
Oh, geez.
And his boss was like, we'll take this coloring book thing off your plate. We know you're going through a lot. He's like, no, I must work on Rudolph. It's keeping me alive.
Oh, man.
I have a drive to finish this. I need this more than ever. So.
Wowee. Geez, that's really heavy. That's also tied into old Rudolph. I would never thought. Man.
So with this poem attached to this coloring book, May borrowed a bit of the appeal from A Visit to St. Nicholas because it's in the same meter. It even paraphrases and quotes it a few times. So it's like, you know, this poem, well, some of the things are happening in here, like Santa going on Dasher, on Dancer, blah, blah, blah. That's in here too. So it's very familiar to you.
It's public domain, so easy. I mean, yeah, that poems can be in any kind of meter, but the like that way of doing it, it also feels like, well, this is Christmas. This is how, that's also the way Seuss goes with his stuff too.
So very successful, this book. 2.4 million copies of the book were given away in the first year of its publication, though it took a bit of a time for Rudolph to become a mass market character. So the success of this book was huge. May was still just a copywriter at Montgomery Ward. He was swimming in debt from his dead wife's medical bills and in a lot of financial trouble. But still working at the company, World War II ends, and a Christmas miracle happens because his bosses say, you know what? We'll give you the rights to Rudolph. We don't see a future for this character, and that's why Montgomery Ward does not exist.
Wow.
Because they gave the rights to the creator.
Well, you're right. They would have... Or Rudolph would just be like a completely forgotten character for a one-off ad if they hadn't given it away. But wow, probably because of moments like this, this is why companies go like, ah, fuck, we were nice once, never.
They tell the story in boardrooms of the jerks who gave away Rudolph for some guy and his dead wife.
Because you felt bad about a dead wife, you gave away Rudolph. It's also the timing, I never considered it before, but the timing of the rise of Rudolph just as Adolf was taken off in Germany. It's like it. No person can be named Adolf, but I guess, you know, it helps that Rudolph, if you know somebody named Dolph, it's like, it's short for Rudolph. Yeah.
Well, he got in just as the war was kicking off and we were still like, we're not coming. Yep, we don't like this war.
And we're not sure. And also, don't send your boats over here. We don't want them.
But May gets the rights to Rudolph. We could chart Rudolph's rise to fame through several adaptations before this one. So there is a mass market paperback version of the story released in 1947. And then the Fleischer Studios releases a color short in 1948 that's a faithful adaptation of the original story. And also Riff Tracks did a riff of it. And it's very funny.
Right. Yeah. I would see tapes all the time as kid, when like those $2 VHSs that would have all of the public domain stuff on it. I remember seeing like, oh, that's a weird looking Rudolph that like looks older than the Rudolph I know, but it also like looks wrong. Like where'd this come from? That's so funny that Fleischer did it themselves.
And I read the original poem for the first time, and obviously it's very different from the short, but actually what the short does to expand the story kind of tampers with the morality, where Santa is not aware of Rudolph for most of the story. Actually, a lot of the story is Santa just fucking up and having a horrible night because there's so much fog. But he goes down one chimney, and it's Rudolph's chimney, and he's like, oh, that nose will come in handy. Come with me. It's not like he knows about Rudolph. He thinks he sucks.
Wow.
Like, he doesn't meet Rudolph until that night.
It's more that the guy, like, he's an unaware god.
Yes.
Who then comes upon him accidentally.
He's chosen. So Santa Claus comes off much better in the coloring book version.
Yeah. Santa's a real jerk in the version we know and love. Yes. I'm shocked.
He really sucks. So 1947, paperback. 1948, cartoon. 1949, we have the adaptation that really put him on the map before the 1964 special, and let me play a clip.
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows.
So that is Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, with his 1949 rendition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah, this is the one, if you ask me to think of a version of this song, if it's not the one from the special, it's this one. Like, this is the most famous one. Like, I couldn't name a Gene Autry regular song.
Same here.
I know his Christmas songs.
And the Burl Ives version just completely overwrote this, I think. It's the one I hear all the time.
If this one appears in, you know, my Christmas classics, radio station or whatever. I'm like, oh yeah, the other one. But I, it's one of those things where it just becomes unassociated from the other one. Like, even though it predates it by, 15 years, the other one just feels like it's forever, you know, mm-hmm. the pearlized version. Yeah.
You just associated with that singing snowman. Mm-hmm. And how this came to be is very interesting. So May's brother-in-law was songwriter Johnny Marks, who would go on to write all the music for this special, by the way.
Oh, okay.
So he was like, let's adapt Rudolph into a hit song. And that's what he did. And this song was originally sung at a radio performance by the crooner Harry Brannan. But the same year, this was released and sung by Gene Autry during Christmas week. And rocketed up to number one.
Wait, what? Wow, Christmas week. Jeez.
When you look at the way Christmas shopping seasons have expanded, Christmas didn't really start until a week before Christmas at this time period.
Yeah, you know, our parents complaining like Christmas starts earlier every year. When you put it in that perspective, it's like, oh yeah, in their childhoods, it was 1 week of like, hey, you're about to have next week off for Christmas. A couple days off for Christmas from school. This is when your parents are going to buy you stuff.
I'm putting up my tree on November 1st.
Oh, yeah. If I guess Nightmare Before Christmas makes it clear. Like, no, Christmas time starts now. Yeah. Halloween's over, Christmas right now.
So, yeah, the way it worked again is May has a brother-in-law named Johnny Marks. Marks writes the song. Gene Autry sings it. Mega hit. And I'm sure May never had to worry about money for the rest of his life. He passed away in 1976. So between the residuals on that and the special, I'm sure he was just like a mega billionaire.
That's cool. He got to live for like 12 years of seeing it go as extremely mainstream. Like, once you have a hit with Gene Autry and these other like adaptations, that's one thing. But yeah, the Rankin Bass thing takes it to a whole nother level. But also that brother-in-law, then that... He must be related to the wife that died then.
You know what? I never thought about it that way.
That's unless he had remarried, it was a different one. But yeah, that's even more interesting that like the writer of all the songs in this special and the original music version is also the brother of his wife that caused him to have all this horrible like medical debt. Jeez.
A lot of things happen in the story because people are either related to Johnny Marks or live next door to him. And we'll get into that very soon.
Some could call that cronyism and favoritism, but man, everything now is so executive and corporately run. It feels sweeter. I
want more people hiring their brother-in-law.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that is the entire history of Rudolph, the character, before this special airs. So now we can talk about Rankin Bass. So there's a lot to cover because they existed for like, 30-ish years kind of. But for the sake of the podcast, we're only going to go up to their founding to the making of Rudolph because they made a ton of Christmas specials after this. It was just the Christmas special factory until the very early 80s from this point onwards. So like 15 years of nothing but Christmas specials. So I have to thank Rankin Bass historian Rick Goldschmidt, who wrote a book on the making of Rudolph 20 years ago, which means he managed to interview almost everyone who was still alive. Mm-hmm. Now, you lent me the Blu-ray of Rudolph, and nobody is alive.
Right.
So nobody can talk about this who actually made it, but like people like Henry Selick are on it, who directed Nightmare Before Christmas. And so it's just like people commenting on growing up with it. But basically in the 90s, everyone died.
Yeah. It was the 60s. Everybody's a heart. If they even lived into the 90s, they lived a long time. You know, it's like the same deal with, we were so lucky in the Grinch one that's coming later that they were able to do like a commentary with Phil Roman, who was like very young when he made it. And June Foray lived almost to 100. But most people who made stuff in the 60s do not live into their 90s. And on that Blu-ray that was released by Universal or Comcast, I should say, really. But the most interesting thing in it is just how they're pushing like Elf in it, because Elf is full of references to this special.
Okay.
So
still haven't seen it. I still want to. So yeah, thanks to Rick Goldschmidt, who wrote some great histories. The funny thing about his books is they're very cute. I'm saying that in a non-patronizing way because they were written really before the internet came around. they're written for an earlier internet, so there was no Wikipedia. So one of the books is just like, well, here's every special and what they're about, because it's 1998. You're like, wasn't there one about Pinocchio? Oh, let me get that book. Oh, I didn't just dream that. It's real. It really happened.
Because Rankin Bass was so prolific. Like, in my youth, there was a bit where the, I guess it was called ABC Family at the time, or the Family Channel, they got the rights to the Rankin Bass catalog. And they're like, it's the 24 days of Christmas and a new rank. We're going to air different special each week or every day. And I thought, How can there be this many? I never, wait, this too? The long-eared donkey? What? What?
There's a ton of them. And yeah. Goldschmidt is the historian for the company. He runs the website, which looks like it was made in 1996.
Which I love.
It's adorable.
I love that. Yeah.
And his blog, which he updates like every day, is also a mid-90s style blog. So
amazing.
If you want to go back in a time machine, he's still doing this and he's still doing a great job. And he's the guy everyone talks to when they want to talk about Rankin Bass.
Because he knew the people. Like, yeah, when doing research on Frosty, I was like, the three best articles about this are just talking to him about the history. Yeah.
So let's get into Rankin Bass. So the name Rankin Bass comes from its two founders. Those are Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass. So where do they come from? Before forming their company, Rankin began his career as an art director at ABC in the 1940s, and Bass worked at an ad agency in New York. So Rankin was more of the art guy and Bass was more of the copywriting ad guy. But,
okay.
You know, advertising is a visual medium, too. So they were both kind of artists in their own way.
Yeah. And Hanna-Barbera worked in a similar like split style of like you oversee the animation. I oversee selling the things and also casting that.
Yeah. I think there's a story from Rankin. He said that people would always be amazed when they saw them in the same room together because they were just, I mean, we'll talk about it. Rankin was just in Japan overseeing things and Bass was back at home going over the business details and everything. So yeah, they just had split the operation. And apparently they were like really good friends and worked together. Unlike Hanna-Barbera,
right, yes.
Were vicious enemies.
They sure were.
Yes. So they wouldn't become Rankin Bass Productions until Bass became a partner in the late 60s, which is why this is a Videocraft International production.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of names that appear, like so many businesses. Like,
yeah.
You know, streamline, simplify, man.
Rankin Bass is better.
Yeah.
So they both worked in visual mediums and the two men turned to the very lucrative world of children's television. But instead of going the Hanna-Barbera route, because, you know, Huckleberry Hound, very popular in the late 50s, early 60s, the two men opted for a form of animation that wasn't seen very much on television, and that is stop motion animation, of course,
because it's way harder to do. Like I would assume, like, I mean, the animation that Hanna-Barbera and much worse companies were putting out on TV then, they had found a very cheap way to do it and to just pump out the footage. But you can't animate as cheaply in that style.
And there also wasn't a system that trains stop motion animators. Like Art Kolokhi was trained by an experimental Russian filmmaker. That's
right.
Why he knew how to do it. He had to train other people. There was no system in place where you learn how this works and how to do it, at least in America.
No, yeah, you're totally right. All the Hanna-Barbera guys that they could hire, they had worked for decades on real animation at Disney, MGM, Warner. And so they could at least, like, once they get to TV, they can go, like, take those skills and adapt them to putting out, like, a fourth as many drawings per minute and just do that. But this is much more the Wild West. And, yeah, all this children's entertainment, you know, they sold crap to kids before the war, but all the kids born after World War II were soaking up entertainment like no tomorrow, man.
And this is where Tadahito Tad Mochinaga enters the picture. So he was born in 1919 and he entered the world of animation in Japan and started by working on propaganda films, which he deeply regretted later in life.
At least he regretted, but it was like, if you weren't going to work on propaganda as an artist, then I don't know what else you were
going to
do.
You were going to die, probably.
Or at least like not have work.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it was an empire. Yeah.
So his life story is like fascinating and harrowing. So I'm going to simplify it for the sake of this podcast. So Japan was losing the war. His hometown was destroyed, and he was afraid that once America occupied Japan, they would be purging all of the propagandists, of which he was one of them.
Yes, yeah. A realistic fear to have there.
Yes,
yeah.
I'd be afraid of Americans. So he fled to China with his pregnant wife. So we'll talk more about that later, but one of the propaganda films he worked on was called Momotaro's Sea Eagles, which was screened for children during the war and was said to have directly inspired Osamu Tezuka.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that one before. Yeah, it's, I mean, there was so little animation produced pre-1950, like, that any of it that exists is very memorable.
Yeah, it's all on YouTube. It's 37 minutes long. You don't want to watch it all because it's kind of dreary and boring, but the funnest parts are Momotaro and the sea eagles are fighting an American soldier on a battleship, and that American soldier is Bluto.
Oh, man.
Because they didn't give a shit about copyrights.
Yeah.
And they love Popeye. They love Popeye.
And they've had to see this Popeye cartoon where he beats up a very racist depiction mm-hmm. of a Japanese guy. So fair play on there. I want to see this just to see him kill Bluto. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's the funnest part of the short. Again, it's on YouTube. So yeah, he flees to China. A lot to go over here, but he ends up popularizing the medium of stop motion animation in China out of necessity because there's a Chinese civil war. Paint is really hard to find, so Mochinaga improvises and photographs puppets in order to make stop motion animation.
Oh.
And people in China had never seen this before, and they associated with like the puppet culture that they had there. Kids watch puppet shows all the time in person. So they're like, well, this is great. So he popularized that in China and kind of figured it out on his own out of necessity.
Wow, that's so cool. That's how he was doing it just out of also like desperation to just live while in hiding from the people who just took over his country. Wow.
And apparently he was working with a lot of Japanese citizens who had also fled to China to avoid prosecution and purges.
Wow, man.
So he returns to Japan by 1954, and then by 1958, he has a successful commercial studio of his own. And here he makes stop-motion films based on classic folktales. And this is where Rankin-Bass enters the picture, because in 1958, they saw his Little Black Sambo short. Yes, that was a popular folktale of the time.
Oh.
And you know what? George Powell loved that character. He's another stop-motion guy. You can see that guy, that little racist figure in a lot of his films.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, that was screened at the very first Vancouver Film Festival, and it won a major award.
Wow. That's... every word of that is very confusing to me. I should have realized, you know, that racist depictions of African Americans or black people is at the core of so much media. Like, it's the first sound picture.
Yes.
All of these things. And now I should have realized the same.
I mean, minstrel culture is the first kind of American culture there was.
Yeah.
American pop culture, really.
No, and I mean, there's, as most animation aficionados know, there's a reason that Mickey wears gloves, mm-hmm. and then same with Bugs Bunny.
It was the style at the time.
Yeah.
But Mochinaga makes this Little Black Sambo short. Rankin sees it in Vancouver, and it really lights his mind on fire. Like, well, this looks amazing. I love how this is crafted. People are going to be so attracted if they see this on TV. So he wants to make a stop motion series with Mochinaga. So Mochinaga gets in touch with him. Mochinaga expands his studio by joining forces with a lot of his old war propaganda buddies. And they form MOM Productions and get to work animating 135-minute segments of something called The New Adventures of Pinocchio, which is the first Animagic production.
Wow. Okay, so it starts with Pinocchio. That's a nice public domain character already made internationally famous in part by Walt Disney in his film. And that can, like, travel to so many different countries, but... I can't get over that, like, all these Imperial Japanese propagandists would go on to create one of, like, the most American things of the 1960s.
I think,
like,
it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it is.
It's
kind of
fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of people that work on this in terms of the American and Japanese side will go on to work on the Rudolph special. But a lot of this is on YouTube, The New Adventures of Pinocchio. And it reminds me a bit of the early Gumby shorts in that it's kind of surreal. It's kind of nightmarish. And there's a crudeness to it. But you can see the designs are there. The art form is there. But they're kind of learning on the job, so it's very crude, but a lot of it is on YouTube if you want to see it.
That 5-minute format also sounds perfect to sell to the Howdy Doody show and other local clowns to show, like, a 5-minute Pinocchio short.
If you were a clown, it was a buyer's market for cartoons.
Well, the boom is already happening in Japan, like all these studios building up. Like, this is why, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle history, they thought they could outsource it to Japan, the animation in 1960. But when they go there, they say that they're told, oh, well, yeah, we'll build the studio after you buy this from us. And they're like, well, no, we're not starting a studio. We thought you guys had a studio.
In this case, it sounds like Rankin helped fund the expansion of the studio or something like that.
No, it sounds like Rankin put a lot of the money into it and was very, I guess they weren't too upfront about Japanese people making it back then.
No, but you know, it strikes me as surprisingly progressive, even though it was a savvy business move as well, that Rankin and Bass, this is like 15 years after World War II, like, hey, Japanese people, let's work together.
Yes, yeah, I know.
There was animosity towards the Japanese when I was a kid.
I know, just about buying Japanese cars, yeah. Even. Yeah, we got to see all the racism just about 9/11.
Yeah.
Like, and we didn't even, declare war. Well, I guess we did. Whatever. I'm just saying, I'm surprised that even a businessman, I guess the all ID dollar wins in the end.
Really does.
Yeah.
So Animagic is similar to George Powell's Puppet Toons more than Art Clokey's Gumby shorts, because these were doll-like figures with movable parts and replaceable faces and mouths instead of, clay figures you kind of bend and move around. Mm. And it makes it much easier to do. And it gives them, they're more durable too, these figures.
Yeah, you don't get the wonderful shifting thumbprints on Gumby at all corners, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what all modern stop-motion animation has been for a long time, except for Aardman. Like, they still stick to the plasticine or whatever figures
instead
of actually just having the puppets, for lack of a better word, that move around.
I always thought, I grew up so much on Gumby, I thought they all were just like, oh, you're shifting around Gumby. It's like, no, we move ahead. Like, when we did Nightmare Before Christmas, that was, as a kid, finding out, like, no, we just have, like, 80 heads of Skellington and just shift them around.
Like, some puppets have replaceable faces. Some have, like, hinged jaws. You can definitely see on the screen. Some have, like, the Robot Chicken where it's, like, the sticker of a mouth. They just stick on there.
I love that in Robot Chicken. And in this special when you can tell, like, oh, they just put a new sticker on his mouth instead.
I think Hermie has a sticker mouth.
Yes.
So what is next for Rankin Bass before Rudolph? Well, they actually make a traditionally animated series in Canada called Tales of the Wizard of Oz, but nobody cares about that. So let's move on to the main attraction. By the way, that's on YouTube as well, and it's very UPA inspired. A lot of the look of this and their past stuff is really drawn from UPA style. But yes, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So this all starts in late 1962. General Electric wants a Christmas special for 1964 that will also help sell their electrical products. Mm. So there's a reason why Rudolph's nose is a goddamn light bulb.
Man.
It's because of GE, the pinheads at GE.
Goddamn. Yes. I should have known. That makes it even funnier that Blu-ray I bought is owned by
Universal,
which are the guys who bought the NBC from GE.
That's perfect. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. So I guess Rankin is in touch with them because I believe something they made for them before this was part of their, like, a color fantasy hour or something like that. They made the special for them before Rudolph, so they're already in touch with GE. And Rankin is like, oh, I live next door to Johnny Marks. He's the guy who wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. We live in brownstones next to each other. We're socially familiar but not friends. And he goes to Marks to get approval for this. Marks is like, well, no, Rudolph is very popular as a song. I don't want some cartoon to tarnish my song and the quality of it. People look down on it. And Rankin eventually, like, just, like, browbeats him and wins him over and gets him to write new songs for the special. So
it all comes from just being a neighbor to the guy. Yeah. Like, well, what all specials can we do? But, like, what a big choice that here they did Wizard of Oz and Pinocchio, two very famous, brands, but public domain. They don't have to get the rights to them for anything. Then they pick one that, like, they actually do need to get the rights to, but it's the neighbor, a guy they know, and they can actually get a handshake agreement on it. That's great.
It's a real good deal to live next door to a guy like that because... Oh, yeah. Yeah, Marks, he wrote Rudolph, the song version. He also wrote a song called Have a Holly Jolly Christmas, which existed before this special.
Oh, okay.
And then he would write the other songs in this special as well, which didn't really go on to be big hits outside of maybe Silver and Gold. Do you hear that on the radio?
I hear it a little bit, yeah. The rest, not hits, though, still ringing around in my head all these years later.
So, I mean, I don't need to tell you this, but this will work out very well for General Electric because they were able to use the characters who were extremely popular in both television and print ads thanks to their funding of this Christmas special that was part of the deal. Like, you make us characters, we'll fund the special. It's a great deal for both of us.
It just set up, so they go from being a Montgomery Ward character to setting up all the electronics, which, like, in 64. Now that runs the modern white suburban life for all of these GE products.
The miracle of electricity.
Yeah.
Your electric kitchen. But yeah, so actually the thing that they did before with General Electric was a Return to Oz TV special. So there was the animated series, then they did a TV special called Return to Oz, and even though it received a lukewarm reaction, GE thought, you know, you guys can do a good job.
you prove that you can finish something and put it on TV.
Yeah. So this was a very expensive production at the time. Normally, Rankin and Bass would go to like banks to get loans for these things, and then, you know, GE stepped in and funded one of their things. So this was made over the course of 18 months on a $500,000 budget. So to put that in comparison to something that we do know about from this era, so we have a Charlie Brown Christmas made next year in 65. That was made for like $90,000 in 6 months.
Wow, which is way more than a half hour of Rocky and Bullwinkle cost.
Yes.
By comparison.
This is a lot of money and a lot of time, but they really, really believe in this, and they really want to show off the stop motion Japanese animators who have been working on this Pinocchio thing for so long, and they're ready for a bigger step, a more ambitious step.
That's like, you know, that's in Disney territory, that much money being spent on it. And that's, I guess that's what, when you work with as big a company as it gets post-World War II in GE, like that's the kind of money you'd spend. But then also the GE's like, we want this for almost 2 years from now in Christmas. Like,
it's late 62, and then it doesn't air until Christmas 64.
That's so wild. Yeah. They spent that much. Like, and also I just can't get over like how different things are now that the, I don't know. I feel that an issue I have with television production these days is, or movies too, it's all the same. But the people who give the money to the creators to make it, at GE, they don't think they know how to write a kid's cartoon or have like story notes. They're just like, hey, you guys just do it. Like now every executive is like, well, I think I know more about story than you. Like they don't just hand you the check. They also have to give you notes on your writing.
They took like one creative writing class in college. Like, well, this is easy.
You know, I read that Robert McKee book and I have a feeling that Rudolph should do this.
We need to save the cat moment in this special.
Yep.
So some general details about the production. Each of these figures you'll see in the special, they cost around $5,000 each to make.
Wow.
They're very meticulously made to both repel dirt and to move without breaking, and they're very solidly built so they don't like move between taking frames of animation.
And that's this was a great point on that doc that's on the Blu-ray of just, you know, you have to re-center your brain on this stuff, because I just think like, well, yeah, the computer did it, like that's how that character flies, or that's how this character gets. They remind you like, no, physically, how could they do this with their tech in the 1963? You know, it's almost impossible to fathom doing it. That's the real magic.
Definitely. From an account from someone who was there at the studio at the time, they said their instructions for the animation, like how to do everything, was like a really complicated printout that looked like computer programming. So they really had to figure this out ahead of time. There was no monitor on the set showing you, well, here's what the last 10 seconds look like.
Right. Yeah. They don't have instant playback on that stuff. It has to, you have to develop the film.
Very complicated.
Holy crap. Yeah.
It's a miracle it looks this good. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they cost around $5,000 each to make, and they're all around about 8 inches tall. The Bumble is, I think, like 14 inches tall. So these are big, big figures moving around.
Those Bumbles bounce.
They do. That's also animagic. And most of the sets were 6 feet by 8 feet with a 7 foot backdrop, just to give you a sense of what these things looked like in real life. And more about the production. So Rankin was in Japan overseeing all of this. And he went with Mochinaga, the animation director, to Nara National Park. And in case you don't know, Nara is like the deer city in Japan, famous for all of its deer. So they just stayed in there for 2 days to study how deer moved and how they, you know, frolicked with each other to get all the movements right. So they were really serious about this.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's cool. You know, I always been meaning to go to that park. And now that I can also connect it to the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer special, it's all the more reason to head there.
And I don't need to tell you this, Henry, but the show was a big hit. It got a 55 share during its first airing, which means more than half of TVs were tuned to it.
Wow.
I mean, also there were three channels.
Sure,
but still, it's a big deal.
The biggest thing that's on TV now, like the Super Bowl, if one out of every 10 people who own a TV watch it, that's the biggest ratings of the year.
And apparently, according to Goldschmidt's book, in 1995, it got a 65 share. So,
whoa!
It even outdid the original airing. Like, it's always above 50, it seems like.
Wow.
At least in recent history, maybe not.
That is a perennial classic, then.
Yeah.
That you can still, for 30 years later, get that kind of rating. That's insane.
I mean, does it feel like to you this is the most popular special? I mean, we're doing Grinch and Frosty soon. We've done Charlie Brown and Garfield. It feels like this could be the most timeless one.
I think it is. You know, we cover Grinch, but it's and that's in the future. But I think Grinch like lives in the shadow of this. They all exist because this one was so big. So it has like originator status, even though, like you said, Magoo is before it. But this made a way bigger splash than Magoo. And then on top of that, like so many other specials that became timeless in their own right, like Nightmare Before Christmas, they are in tribute to this. They exist
absolutely.
Because of this.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, with, you know, the Peanut special is great, but it's one of a bunch of Peanut specials. Like, it's not, even though Rudolph would appear in other things.
He had a Shiny New Year. He had Christmas in July.
Exactly.
There was the Christmas Reindeer Goes to Summer Camp movie, of course.
There was, which it was the super team up of like, everybody thought Batman v Superman was the big deal. No, Frosty and Rudolph finally teaming up.
Let's get Pinocchio in there, too.
Yeah.
and as far as I know, in terms of air history, it's aired consistently on CBS every holiday season since 1964. And in fact, it just aired on November 22nd of this year on CBS. I checked.
Man.
And it also airs on Freeform, and they show the expanded version.
Right. Yeah, that was a big deal that the Family Channel got all the Rankin movies. They spent huge money to get the Rankin TV rights for cable while still respecting some of the CBS rights. Like, that's the funny thing, too, how they end up with this giant catalog of films at Rankin Bass, because they could replay Rudolph every year, but also the channels, and not just CBS, wanted more specials.
Mm-hmm.
But those specials were never as special as Rudolph, so
yeah,
they'd get played a few years in a row, but eventually they're like, not really a demand for the 'Twas the Night Before Christmas special.
It should
whatever.
Be said, out of all these Rankin Bass ones, I've seen this a ton. And I think I've only ever seen outside of this, is it called Santa Claus is Coming to Town?
Yeah, the Mickey Rooney one.
Yeah. I think that's the only other one I saw, and that bothered me as a kid because I couldn't wrap my head around my mind around the idea of Santa Claus being young with red hair. I couldn't buy that character as Santa Claus. I was just a pedantic little kid, I guess.
Yeah, I liked the origin story. Their origin story is Santa Claus with the Bürgermeister, but they always had good songs in them, but I never watched them with the amount of times I watched this. Like, certainly I watched Frosty, and I watched a tiny bit of Little Drummer Boy as well. And I forget which special. Is it A Year Without Santa Claus? The one with the Heat Miser and the Snow Miser. Those songs are stuck in my head.
You know, I see like Gen Xers reference the Heat Miser and Snow Miser. I like their designs. I've never seen them in my life.
The
actual figures moving around.
I think I also have the Heat Miser and Snow Miser were so big, they got their own like update special. Like, made by Rankin Bass in like 2000s or whatever. But I also remember them because Conan O'Brien had a perfect sketch of saying like, we watched some of these Christmas specials, but they're different now. And the joke was that it starts the Snow Miser songs like, I'm Mr. Snow Miser, I'm Mr. Cold, I'm Mr. Snow Miser, I'm Mr. Cold. And they just play that on a loop for 5 minutes straight.
That sounds like a Conan sketch to me.
Yes. But yeah, as for all of the other ones, like the dozens of other ones, I never saw them until those 24 days of Christmas on the channel that became Freeform.
Well, now we could talk about the controversial changes. So one of the things in Goldschmidt's book that's very cute, again, not being patronizing, it's a pre-internet kind of book where you can just go to IMDb now and say what scenes were cut. But the book served that purpose then. Like, didn't this movie used to have a war? Well, the book would tell you. It's like, yes, they cut it out. So this book details a lot of changes that happened to Rudolph. So this is the one time where there was executive meddling, Henry.
Oh.
So at the behest of a General Electric executive, the song We're a Couple of Misfits was replaced by the new song Fame and Fortune, as well as a new animated sequence to go along with it. And We're a Couple of Misfits would not return until the 1998 airing. And this was heavily advertised by CBS.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What a fucking, man, I can't believe that. I love that song. We're a Couple of Misfits.
I don't know how I remember that that song because I was watching the version with Fame and Fortune, but I remember both songs.
Yeah, I remember the Misfits song way more than I remember Fame and Fortune. Yeah.
But yeah, Misfits aired once in 64. General Electric was like, get some Fame and Fortune in here. It's the 60s. And then they sing that until 1998.
Wow, yeah. Man. And they reanimated an entire song. That's a whole lot.
And apparently I looked at it, it's like it's a little off. They didn't spend as much time on it, and the Misfits sequence is much better. In the Misfits sequence, Hermie rides on Rudolph and Rudolph bucks him off. He's like, I'm your friend.
Yeah, hey, yes. We're equals here. You don't ride me. Like, let's get one thing straight right now, Hermie.
But I love the Misfits song. I like how Hermie just punches a snowman.
There's so much funny stuff in there. And it's two weirdos complaining about how they don't fit in society.
It's a song about resentment.
Yeah, exactly. It needs to be about resentment. That's core to the thing. It's not about like how I want to be famous. Like, that is okay. I take back all the compliments I had to the wonderful executives at GE.
Yes, that one just didn't like the Misfits song.
Yeah.
Probably thinking of Beatniks or something. So also, people were very pissed off that Santa did not fulfill his original promise to the Misfit toys, because in 1964, their plotline ends. Santa does not come back for them.
Damn. So I didn't know.
Yeah, in the next airing in 65, they animate a new scene at the end where Santa Claus comes back and picks up the Misfit toys, and there's a new ending sequence as well in which the Misfit toys are delivered. In the original ending sequence, they're just delivering nondescript gifts. So there's a new sequence with Santa getting the toys and a new ending sequence with credits of the toys being handed little umbrellas and jumping out.
See, now that I do, I never saw that other version of it, but that is a good update, because that's like the DLC update to Mass Effect 3.
Yes.
People are like, no, this ending needs to be better. This is a bad ending. But totally, if you're a little kid, I can see how adults writing it maybe don't understand why that's important. But to a child watching it, especially who sees all these sad little toys on the island, and they just never get anything. They're just like, oh, I guess they're stuck on this island forever.
They have to suffer in that hell. Actually, Rankin was asked in the book, you know, what was wrong with that doll? It seemed perfectly fine. And he was like, we couldn't come up with a story for all of them. But then he made something up, because he's like, the doll was depressed. They give it Prozac today if it was still around.
It's cute. That's cute. Yeah. You're right. I think you're right. They just couldn't. They didn't think of something. They just did bad writing.
So because they added a new scene with the picking up of the Misfit toys and the delivering of the Misfit toys, a few cuts had to be made, including the resolution of Yukon Cornelius' story. So throughout the special, he's seen throwing the pickaxe in the air. It lands in the ground. He picks it up and licks it. And people were thinking, like, why is he doing this? Well, you find out at the end when he finds a peppermint mine. He finally tastes the pick and it tastes like peppermint. But that scene was cut out of most broadcasts, would not air again on TV until 2019.
Yes, that watching it on the Blu-ray, I was like, wait, what? Peppermint? The hell? Like, yeah, I never knew that.
People assumed, like, oh, if you lick the end of the pickaxe, you'll know if they're silver and gold. But no, the big payoff is like, no, he was looking for a candy mine.
Wow.